And this is John Quinlan with Stephanie Woods in this January 11th, 2009 edition of Forward Forum.
From a distance, the world looks blue and green, and the snow-capped mountains white. From a distance, the ocean meets the stream, and the eagle takes to flight.
On tonight's Forward Forum, coming up in our 7 o'clock hour, we have a fascinating discussion with author Jeffrey Garver on the line from up in Montreal. He is the author of Right Relationship, Building a Whole Earth Economy. President Jimmy Carter, in a dedication to the book, says, "We are all stewards of the earth, but often lack specific information and advice on what we can do personally and collectively. Right Relationship provides a wonderful guide for all of us. Discussion at this time of economic downturn, how we can turn things around for our individual lives and yet still not sacrifice the fate of the earth." Very powerful discussion coming up. Again, as I mentioned, beginning the show tonight, we have a very special guest, Jeffrey Garver. He's an environmental consultant and lecturer in law based out of Montreal. And from 2000 to 2007, he was a senior official at the North American Commission for Environmental Cooperation, directing the unit that publishes detailed factual investigations of complaints by North American citizens in the NAFTA countries. It's Mexico, U.S., and Canada, and how in many ways they're failing to effectively enforce their environmental laws. He just has a very distinguished career, going back to having been part of the U.S. Justice Department, worked as a clerk for a federal court out of Bangor, Maine, and he is native of Western rural New York, having grown up in a Quaker family. And we'll find out in just a moment why those Quaker connections are also very important. Jeff Garver, welcome to Forward Forum.
Hello, John. It's a real pleasure to be joining you. How are things in Madison?
Very cold, kind of as always. We're about to, I think, hit our break the snow record we hit last year and all of that. But other than that, lots of excitement, I think, with the new year and a new administration coming up down here. Actually, as we go into this discussion, I know you don't necessarily explicitly talk about that transition in your book, but I'm just curious. Is there perhaps some optimism that with some changes that are happening down here in Washington that maybe there might be a heightened attention to issues of the environment?
Oh, I think there's no question that that we're in for a new approach, a radically different approach in regard to some of the big questions, environmental questions that we're facing in this part of the world and in the entire world. Global warming, for example, I think is about to get a fresh, new, and much more promising look. I think President-elect Obama has found some very, very interesting people in Energy Secretary Chu designate and Carol Browner, somebody that I worked with at the US EPA and have a lot of respect for. So yes, I think we're in for some better days for the environment.
You know, just in more general terms, as we go into the interview, I'd like to bounce off of you something that we had a recent guest observe. In this case, this was one of the University of Wisconsin people who is part of the UN efforts that received the Nobel Prize along with Al Gore. And Jonathan Patz, I believe, is his name. And he made an observation that perhaps at a time when finally there seems to be some consensus that global warming and all the associated threats are real, that we're moving past a time of denial, and that maybe, just maybe, that you know, once that's achieved, that there are all kinds of things that we can work together on across the globe in terms of the problems that we can solve. Do you share any of that optimism?
Well, I like to be as optimistic as possible on this, and I think it's just terrific that that Al Gore and the climate scientists shared the Nobel Prize. We talk about in our book, Right Relationship: Building a Whole Earth Economy, about the climate change discussions and the potential regulatory structure that could come out of that as being a model that could be applied to the broader ecological crisis we're facing. If we can get ourselves together, the international community, to find a solution for climate change, we've put in place a model that will be very, very powerful. You know, and it's a huge challenge, and we have to do that, figure out how much parts per million of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases we can allow to be in the atmosphere in order to basically continue life on the planet as we know it. And then we have to translate that down into some kind of a sharing system in a world where different countries have had different contributions to the problem, we're all working on an economic model that is always striving for more growth, and there's a huge challenge there. We haven't really figured out very well how to maintain an economy in a way that doesn't tend to overall increase greenhouse gases.
I was mentioning at the outset that in fact you grew up in a Quaker family, and woven throughout the book are different philosophies that are resonant with the philosophy of people who practice Quakerism. I know that in the preface to your book, one of the parallels that you bring in terms of that despite how daunting this is, this might be doable, is to talk about Quaker involvement in abolishing slavery, something that at the time folks thought probably couldn't happen. One of the things you say, you and your co-author say at the end of that preface, is economics based on consumerism and obsession with growth has become, in effect, the modern world state-sponsored religion. This economy now needs, for the sake of the human future and indeed the future of the entire community of life, the same wind of change that was earlier directed at abolishing the economy of slavery.
Yeah, we drew a lot of inspiration from those stories. Just to carry that point a little bit further, the parallel with that time and what we're living now is that people, and including Quakers, who owned slaves, just couldn't imagine an economy that didn't have slaves. It was very, very challenging to get past that initial question: what are we going to do without our slaves? And you know, in terms of the challenges today, we tend to think, well, what are we going to, you know, how are we going to maintain jobs? How are we going to maintain things day to day if we start moving towards an economy where we're consuming less and consuming more within the capacity, the ecological capacity of the Earth. We did draw a lot of inspiration from that and hope, and it really was kind of what brought us together and got us to write this book. And I guess just to finish that off, we are a group of Quakers authors. This notion of right relationship does have roots in Quakerism, but we think it's really a moral guidance system that resonates with different ethical, religious, and cultural traditions all around the world. It has a common base with things, principles we all grew up with, things like the Golden Rule and principles of respect and fair treatment that we all grow up with. So.
I want to pursue some of the other things off of those concepts of right relationship as we go through the hour. But now, as kind of as a basic stepping off point, I know my co-host Stephanie Woods has a question for you.
So, Jeff, the notion of rugged independence is strong in the American character. Your worldview assumes a very different approach, a vision of commonwealth. Tell us about that.
Well, this may be in some ways challenging for many people, but I think we have to remember one thing that we can't escape is that people are part of human communities, and the human community is part of an interdependent a web of life. We are one of many species that share a finite planet. And the new information about our particular time in history is that we're running up against limits that people didn't have to deal with when they were, for example, exploring the West and being, you know, the rugged frontiers person, or many of the things that are associated in the United States about rugged individualism. This notion of community is becoming more and more essential to our collective survival, not just as humans alone, but as humans as part of this interdependent community of life.
And speaking of our interdependent community, you regard the globalized economy as one of the most disastrous events in human history. Why is that?
Well, the fact that different countries around the world are going to interact and trade, there's nothing particularly wrong with that. It's just that the way that we're doing it is built on a kind of a Wild West mentality. I guess keeping with this notion of rugged individualism, look at the history of environmentalism in the United States. At some point, we realized that we were doing things in a way that were kind of spoiling our own nest. And we realized we couldn't let different states, for example, just have their own rules that were more or less designed to attract economic activity. We needed rules that applied to all. We don't have that in the globalized economy. What we have is we have a system that puts human communities and ecological communities, it subjugates them to the onward press for more and more economic growth. And what we see is rising disparities between rich and poor. We see tremendous wealth in certain parts of the world and with certain people, and tremendous poverty. And we haven't figured out how to run a globalized economy that's going to nurture and take care of our various communities. Again, the human community and this, what we call in the book, the commonwealth of life. Humans as part of an interdependent community of life that, again, shares a finite planet.
I think Stephanie's on to something that is somewhat confusing for people. I've just taken on the role of being president of our local United Nations Association. And I think one of the questions that people ask me when I go out and do speaking is, so what are you saying? You're saying globalization is bad, and yet you're saying we should really work all together as a global community. And I guess the distinction being that some type of global activities, for example, the things that are represented by NAFTA, the things that are represented by multinational corporations, those things driven by greed are bad, and the things that are more communitarian are good. Is that sort of the distinction?
Well, I think you're getting onto something there, John. And you introduced me at the beginning as someone that worked for the North American Commission for Environmental Cooperation. What people might not know is that is the NAFTA Environment Commission. When President Clinton said he would sign the NAFTA agreement, he said, "Well, I'll do it if we have a labor side agreement and an environment side agreement." And the environment side agreement created this this commission. And I like to point out to people in that context that my job was to look at these public complaints. So this could come from any individual. You and Stephanie could have filed one of these, saying that in some way one of the governments is failing to effectively enforce its environmental laws. And what you would have gotten out of that, if it was a worthwhile case, is what's called a factual record. It's a detailed, hopefully rigorous and credible statement of facts about the situation. Contrast that with an investor who, on another provision of NAFTA, is allowed to sue a national government if the investor thinks that his or her investment has been somehow treated unfairly or confiscated unfairly by the government, and they can sue through binding arbitration, which is enforceable by the courts, for multi-million dollar awards. This is the kind of imbalance that exists right now in the global community. We don't have a system where there are strict enforceable environmental rules that are designed to keep the economy from overrunning its ecological base.
So what's the alternative?
Well, what we propose in Chapter 5 of our books, and just to give your listeners an idea of how we crafted this book, we talk about this concept of right relationship, a relationship between humans and the earth that is not designed to preserve the integrity and resilience of this commonwealth of life, of the interdependent communities of life on the earth. And we use that concept to answer five questions. What is the economy for? How does it work? How big should it be? What is fair in the economy, and how should it be governed? And when we get to this last question of how it should be governed, we make proposals about, first of all, understanding much more about the ecological capacity of the Earth and how it's related to our economy, and then designing systems that are going to, just like I was explaining with climate change at the beginning, are going to figure out a fair way for sharing that limited ecological capacity among the various people of the world. And unfortunately, we're far beyond that capacity already. We have a very, very difficult situation.
We're talking with Jeffrey Garver, who is the co-author with Peter Brown of Right Relationship, Building a Whole Earth Economy.
And Jeff, one of the questions that I'd like to ask you that I find interesting is something that Americans, I'm hard on Americans quite often just because I'm one of them and it's easier to pick on your own. So simple and yet so telling is the phrase, throw it away. What do you think that reveals about us?
Well, try to imagine any other species on Earth that throws things away, let alone that throws things away in a way that poisons the water that they drink or the food on which they grow their food or get their food. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find that out. We have an economy that is amassing waste in the economy. And what we're proposing in our book is that we've got to try and figure out, again, because we're at a point in history where we're coming up to ecological limits that none of our predecessors had to deal with. We've got to come up with a way that we don't, where there really isn't such a thing as a way as in throw it away.
Yeah.
We live on, we have one home, the planet.
Well, you know, and part of the notion of getting away from that throw it away economy is tied up in this concept of each one of us having a smaller footprint. I just love the imagery that's behind all of that. You know, but that just seems to work as the antithesis of the way we've been told we're supposed to respond in terms of achieving a healthy economy. I remember post 9/11, the thing we were supposed to do to make a better country is go out and spend lots of money. And of course, a lot of that message is coming through right now too. How do you rationalize those two competing ideas?
Yeah, the first thing is that we are absolutely bombarded with messages that tell us to go out and buy things that that feed on our insecurities and tell us that if we want to feel good about ourselves, we have to have all kinds of things. But the per capita footprint of ecological footprint of Americans is approximately twice the footprint of the average European, and many, many more times that of somebody in the developing world. We're using far more than our fair share of the Earth's ecological capacity. So, so what do we do tomorrow? I find that to be a very challenging question. There's a lot of talk right now about a stimulus package that's going to create a green economy. And I think if we have to go through some kind of transition. There's all kinds of sort of low-hanging fruit we can pick in terms of putting in place green infrastructure where the investment is going to have long-term benefits in terms of reducing energy use, which is a big part of our ecological footprint, and other kinds of resource use. So, I don't know. What I have a problem is when we define sustained economic growth as a goal in and of itself.
Mm. I mean, the economy exists for people, does it not?
Well, this is basically, you know, our first chapter is called "What is the Economy For?" And mainstream neoclassical economics says that, yes, the economy is for making as many of us as wealthy as possible. And what we're saying is that we need to be driving towards something different and then figure out detail how to get there. And what we've got to drive towards is having this economy that's in balance with its ecological base.
Jeff, hold on to that thought, and we do have someone who's taken us up on our offer of joining in the conversation. Again, just a reminder, 321-1670, that local number, or if you're calling from further afield, 1-877-867-1670. Karen in Sacramento, California, your question or a comment.
Well, hello. We are interested in building out here, and I know I've read in Bill McKibben's book about local economies that people are starting to develop, such as in Burlington. They have Burlington Bread. And then yesterday I learned about another one in Texas. And do you subscribe to that? How do you feel about people developing their own local currencies?
Jeff Garver?
I'm very intrigued by that, and I think there are some really exciting examples going on with people who have figured out that they should try and live low-impact lives, relying as much as possible on their local economy. So we start chapter one of our book talking about something called the Woodstock Farm Market in Woodstock, New Brunswick, which was built on basic idea that they want to create a market that is appropriate to the social and environmental setting in which it finds itself. And when we talk about how we're going to cope or how we're going to feel fulfilled or have a sense of well-being if we're living in this kind of way, I joined a community-supported agriculture program this year near Montreal, and those are happening all over Canada and the United States right now. And you basically subscribe to a farm at the beginning of the season, and you share their crop with all the other subscribers. And you know that what you're getting is fresh. It's good. I picked a wonderful farm that just the variety of things they had was wonderful. And I had a real sense of joy in going and picking up those local vegetables every week. So, this is an example of how by seeing the big picture, by knowing that if you're depending on a local economy, you're doing something good for the earth, it can give you a new kind of fulfillment that will make all the messages that you're getting bombarded with from advertising and so on seem less important.
Karen, does that seem like a practical thing to do in your own life?
Well, yeah, and also I read a study the other day about how much money it would cost to pay Mother Earth if we were to have to pay her for all the services she provides, and it would be something like $33 trillion.
Wow.
And so it could be that when people develop their business plans, that they ought to start, somebody's got to pick up the tab somehow, or we're not going to have an economy that serves us, and instead we'll be serving the economy like slaves.
Right, and guess what? Gross domestic product, which is what we all have been grown up with, is telling us whether we're in good shape or not, takes no account of the price we owe to Mother Earth.
You know, just an example of what you're both talking about here in Madison, and I hope I'm getting the name right. I don't know why I'm not thinking of this, but the Community Time Bank, I think it's called.
Oh, yeah.
You, Steph, you
yep.
remember? Anyway, it's an organization that started in one part of town on the north side where I happen to live, and it's kind of the concept is spread all around. But it's basically also bartering community service, bartering different people's skills they can exchange with no money exchanged. And it strikes me that might be very well be the future of how we get things done. And does that make sense?
Oh, that sounds wonderful. I just hope we don't get caught.
You know, I've talked to some people involved in these local economy efforts, and they can become the beginning of where we're all headed. I think it'll be very fascinating to see what happens with them.
Hey, Karen, thanks so much for calling. It's good to hear from you.
Thank you.
All right, take care. Steph, you had a different direction slightly to go?
Yeah, Jeff, you note the urgent need for global governance. What forms would this take, and how could we, especially a self-interested nation such as the U.S., ever submit to such external authority? That sounds a little out of the question.
Just to chime in on that, again, being an advocate for a greater role for the United Nations, boy, that's an uphill battle sometimes. People are very suspicious of that. So, so off of all of that, how do we do that?
Well, you know, I read. I'm going to plug another book here, which an author I just think is terrific, a columnist with the Guardian paper in the United Kingdom called George Monbiot, Monbiot, and his got a website monbiot.com. He wrote a book called The Age of Consent, which he talks about how we could build an international global democracy that would be able to respond to some of these ecological and other problems in a new kind of way. What we propose in our book is some kind of global federalism, and we look at the European model, which, although it's not perfect, is one that we could learn a lot from in this part of the world. Again, from my experience working in the NAFTA institutions, we're far behind in figuring out how to come up with regional rules on the environment that make sense. In Europe, the countries started looking at themselves as a community of nations, first from an economic standpoint, and eventually they realized that they were going to be better off if each of the countries gave up a little of its sovereignty in certain areas, like environment, to have a set of Europe-wide rules that everybody had to live by. And, you know, we've done that in the United States. As I said earlier, all the environmental laws that we've adopted in the modern era of environmentalism since the 1970 or so responded to a kind of race to the bottom in terms of the environment that we had going on in the United States. So why shouldn't we have that at the international level, especially when we know that the ecological crisis we're facing, starting with global warming but going much beyond that, is so serious. We put some models out. They don't have to be those models, but what we have to have is some kind of a global regulatory system to deal with global issues.
Makes sense to me.
It makes a lot of sense. And again, just to remind folks, this is Forward Forum. Our guest is Jeffrey Garver. He's the author of Right Relationship, Building a Whole Earth Economy. Jeff, as we explore this idea of, you know, some kind of a global federation, some kind of a global authority, you know, one of the things we already have, but I think you advocate in the book that you'd like to expand it, is to envision some kind of a global court that would make judicial rulings, but in lack of having a global police to enforce those rulings, you know, how do we make this possible?
Well, you need to have a global enforcement. If you have global rules, then you need some system for enforcing those rules through the court. So that's not something that we've described in detail, but it certainly comes with the package. There's no doubt about that. Part of my earlier career was work in the enforcement office in the United States Environmental Protection Agency. For all the talk about voluntary compliance with environmental rules, what makes environmental protection work in the United States is enforceable rules, so of course we would need that as well.
Okay.
At the global level.
All right. We need to take our last break now. Again, we're speaking with Jeffrey Garver. He's the author of Right Relationship, Building a Whole Earth Economy. We invite you to participate in this conversation. This is so fundamental to the dilemma right now. Everybody is really hurting economically. We want to pull out of that situation. But maybe it's a time to look at a new way of doing things and a new set of values that work in harmony with the future of the Earth. We shouldn't have to trade off one for another. And this book offers a really exciting blueprint for making that possible.
As we go marching, marching in the beauty of the day, a million darkened kitchens, a thousand mill lofts gray, are touched with all the radiance that a sudden sun discloses. For the people hear us singing, bread and roses, bread and roses.
And welcome back to Forward Forum. John Quinlan here with my co-host, and for this time anyway, also producer Stephanie Woods. Welcome back, Steph.
Woo-hoo.
And we purposely chose a song kind of evoking the social justice fights of an earlier era, because I think one of the things that folks are feeling right now is resonance with the era of, unfortunately, the Depression. And, you know, one of the other times when we face these great economic challenges. And one would hope that the same kind of rallying, the same kind of communitarianism, seeing the role of government as being able to help people, is going to invoke itself. I ask our guest about that, but just to properly reintroduce him again, we're speaking with Jeffrey Garver, who joins us on the phone from up in Montreal. He's the author of Right Relationship, Building a Whole Earth Economy. Jeff, do you think back at all to the period of the early 30s and the challenges FDR faced coming into his administration and its resonance with what President Obama is going to be facing?
Well, I think we're all thinking about that to some extent. We might not even have seen the worst of the pain we're going to be feeling from this economic downturn. And what's different, though, with the challenge now is that, in addition to the financial crisis, the economic crisis we're feeling in a very immediate way is something that we don't tend to feel as in such an immediate way, which is things like global warming, things like the ecological crisis. We know now that we're reaching new limits in terms of what the Earth can withstand from the human economy. And so coming out of this situation really has to take into that ecological crisis as well. We can't afford not to anymore. We hear from climate scientists, from others, that we may have as little as 10 or 15 years to really turn things around in the way that in the way we get our energy, the way we run our economy, if we're going to continue to be able to live as we are used to living on this planet. You know, that we don't feel that so much, but it's there, and it's an enormous challenge.
Do you make a distinction between maybe some of the powers that be, the corporate leaders who've clearly been leading us down some wrong paths and you know, been driven by greed and short-term gain and other things? Make a distinction between some of those folks and the grassroots. I mean, the those of us who are all Americans, and I say that all North Americans. Let's talk about because we've had recent guests, for example, a woman who wrote a book, The Samaritan's Dilemma, about whether government should be helping people. And you know what we ended up talking about actually for most of the hour was the fact that by and large people really want to help each other, want to work together. This whole spirit of communitarianism is really something that just seems to be part of, just seems to be woven into us. And yet the message we get is, watch out for number one and don't be a pushover in terms of, always trying to help somebody else, especially at times like this. But anyway, I'm just wondering. So what do you think? I know it's hard to paint with a broad brush, all the people of North America. But by and large, do you think we do strive for that higher ethic?
Well, I want to feel the best about although I live in Montreal, I'm an American as well, and I know there is that spirit of community in many Americans, and what we talk about in the book is the need to enclose the spark of competition within an engine of cooperation. So and that I think is very consistent with what you're saying. It's that we can't forget about the community. And one thing that we also point out in the book is we try to get our readers to think of money as a social license, so it's kind of a permission we give to each other to take a piece of a limited ecological pie, a finite earth, something that we have to share. And if we start looking at money from that point of view, just think of the possibilities. Think of the different perspective. You've all of a sudden introduced into the notion of money the notion of sharing and fairness, and treating others as you would like to be treated yourself. So it's going, again, back to something like the golden rule. So that is the different kind of paradigm we're trying to put forth in this book.
Well, there's just extract an interesting detail out of your book. We're still, of course, talking about measuring this in terms of money. We talk about the gross national product, and those are kinds of the bottom lines by which we measure our well-being, our prosperity. But one of the things you note in the book is way over in South Asia, the tiny little Republic of Bhutan, instead of gross national product, they have this thing called GNH, or gross national happiness. How does that work?
Well, that's a wonderful concept, and just it almost says what it is by its name. And what gross national happiness in Bhutan tries to account for is that true development of human society takes place when material and spiritual development occur side by side to complement and reinforce each other. So it tries to account for, its pillars are the promotion of equitable and sustainable socioeconomic development, preservation and promotion of cultural values, conservation of the natural environment, and establishment of good governance. Sounds pretty good to me.
It sure does. Steph, you had something?
I do. I actually have two questions for you, Jeff. The first one is, I talk to so many people who are still just not believing that we're having a problem with our environment, or just not on board with any of these things that we're talking about tonight. How do you think we can reach out to them and get them involved? People are just not willing to give up their luxuries. It's just not something they feel they should have to do.
Yeah, well, we describe what we think are four steps towards the kind of economy and society we would like to see develop. And the beginning one of those is grounding and clarification. It's becoming aware that we do live on a finite earth. And, there's a wonderful book. I don't know what works with certain kinds of people like that. All we can do is try to provide information and keep the discussion going. But there is a wonderful book called Radical Simplicity by an author named Jim Merkel, Merkel. What I love about that book is that it talks about ecological footprint like our book does, and it asks this question again: what do you think? You have to believe, you have to accept the information that's provided, which I certainly do, which is we're already using up the Earth faster than it can regenerate itself. Our ecological footprint collectively is too big, and especially in North America, our individual footprints are much too big. But this book sort of gives you a set of questions to ask yourself. Well, first of all, it tells you how you can calculate your own footprint, and then it asks you to challenge yourself on what you think is your fair share. When you realize you're sharing this limited Earth with other people and other living beings, and not just the ones that exist today, but the ones that you hope will be there in the future.
Mm.
And so you can personalize this and challenge yourself to try and find to get by with less. But if you incorporate this as an inner sense of your spiritual development as well, you'll find, as I've found, for example, doing this community-supported agriculture and other things that I try to do to try and live more lightly on the earth, you develop a sense of fulfillment that comes from having less. Sounds paradoxical, paradoxical perhaps, but it does and can happen.
And at the beginning of your last chapter, you've got a great quote there that says, "A crisis is a terrible thing to waste." What do you mean by that?
You know, what we didn't know when we wrote that is just what was going to happen between the time we finished the book and the time we get published. Which is
what a difference. 3 months back. Amazing.
Economic crisis. Mm. You know, so we now have two crises to deal with. And the crisis we were mostly talking about is this ecological crisis, the fact that we're using up now for the first time in history, and it's something that's only been happening since somewhere in the 1980s. The scientists who've developed ecological footprinting tell us that we're using up the Earth's capacity to support life faster than it can be regenerated. That's a crisis, and it creates an opportunity for us to use the best of the human spirit, the best of human ingenuity, to find out individually and collectively how we can manage, how we can find a way to provide for ourselves and to live full and meaningful lives while having a much lighter touch on the earth.
As you know, Madison, also a city that is very green and very concerned about these issues, and we sure appreciate you joining us and hope you come back again.
Well, I'm delighted to have joined you. Let me just quickly tell your listeners that they can find out more about the book at www.moraleconomy.org. So moral economy all together, www.moraleconomy.org. And I think it's great that you have your show going, and nice to hear about the Quakers there, and I would love to come back and talk to you again.
All right, very good. Again, we've been speaking with Jeffrey Garver. He's the co-author with Peter Brown of Right Relationship, Building a Whole Earth Economy. One more time, that website is moraleconomy.org. Have other relevant links up at our website, forwardforum.net, and the new blog that is listed off of that. It's essentially forwardforumexchange.blogspot.com, but forwardforum.net, you remember that. You'll find it all. Once again, thank you so much, Jeff.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.